I mean, you know the strip perfectly, right? Even if you've never really consciously read it.
Oh, totally. We all know exactly what to do.
Right. The lights in the room suddenly dim. A glowing, sugary cake emerges from the kitchen. A group of people start singing this, you know, slightly off-key song.
Always off-key.
Always. And you are just sitting there, right in the center of it all. You make a wish, you blow out the candles, and, well, you eat the slice of cake. It's just this universal human ritual.
It is entirely predictable, and I think we tend to find comfort in that predictability, right? Because it provides this clear template.
Yeah, you don't have to think about it.
Exactly. It is exactly what society tells us a celebration is supposed to look like. You don't have to think. You just follow the steps.
But today, we're asking you to step back. Like, really step back and look at those steps through a very different lens. When you go through those motions, when you cut that cake and tear open the presents, are you actually celebrating your life and your growth?
That's the big question.
Right. Or are you just performing this, like, highly choreographed ritual of consumption?
And that distinction, I mean, it changes everything about how we view milestones. It forces us to examine something we usually just accept completely on autopilot.
And breaking that autopilot is the whole mission of today's deep dive.
Oh.
We are going to completely rethink the concept of birthdays.
Which is a huge task, honestly.
It is. And to do this, our primary guide today is this really brilliant, thought-provoking blog article. It's titled Your Birthday Celebrations. And it's written by a thinker and writer known as Puru.
Yes, Puru's work is incredibly foundational for this discussion.
Definitely. But we aren't just looking at his philosophy in a vacuum, you know? We're layering his essay with a stack of other fascinating sources. We've got economic data on the party industry, psychological research, and this is my favorite part, even some unexpected studies on animal behavior.
That animal behavior research really contextualizes what it actually means to celebrate. It's fascinating.
So, let's jump in. The core premise we are exploring from Puru's work is that modern society has, well, completely lost the plot when it comes to marking time.
We really have. He argues that we need to fundamentally transform these events. We need to move them from mindless indulgence into profound growth checkpoints.
Growth checkpoints. I love that phrasing. But let's start by looking at the reality Puru is reacting against. In his essay, he describes the modern birthday as a performance of sensation.
A performance of sensation. That's a very striking way to put it.
Right. And he uses this really wild contrast to illustrate how pervasive it has become. So on one hand, you have remote villages in Assam. Historically, impoverished families there might not have even known their exact date of birth.
Sure, it just wasn't tracked in the same way.
Exactly.
Day.
But today, they have been conditioned, and Puru actually used the word brainwashed here, into scraping together whatever money they have to buy unhealthy Western-style cakes from local bakers.
Which just highlights the sheer power of the commercial machine, right? I mean, this isn't some organic tradition rising from within a community to genuinely honor a person's life.
No, not at all.
It's an imported commercial script. It equates buying a specific product with experiencing joy.
And he contrasts those rural villages with modern Indian cities where that script has just been amplified to an extreme degree.
Oh, the midnight celebrations?
Yes. You have this mandatory cutting of heavily refined flour cakes at exactly midnight.
Mm.
And then, this is the crazy part, you have people violently smashing that cake into the face of the person they're supposed to be celebrating.
Which makes no sense if you really think about it.
None. And there's even this genuinely dangerous tradition of giving birthday bumps. Like, literally throwing the person in the air and punching or kicking them.
It's just wild. And we can trace how this became the default, actually, without getting, you know, too bogged down in the history.
Right. Keep it brief for us.
Yeah. So basically, birthdays started out just for gods and rulers. Think pharaohs or the ancient Greeks. And while places like Persia embraced them early on, cultures like China actually resisted them for a long time due to Confucian values.
Oh, interesting. So when did it become this massive thing for everyone?
The shift really happened when the Industrial Revolution collided with the rise of modern individualism. Suddenly, you had mass production of sugar, decorations, party supplies. All of it became cheap and accessible.
So it was just a perfect storm of cheap goods and a focus on the individual.
Exactly. Your date of birth transformed from a simple biological fact into a highly marketable, recurring personal holiday.
And man, the economic data we have perfectly illustrates how the market capitalized on that. Like, we are not just talking about a family buying a few balloons here.
No, it's a massive industry.
It's a multi-billion-dollar machine. The global birthday party industry is valued at roughly $11.4 billion, and the greeting card industry alone, $19.61 billion.
It's staggering.
And the fuel keeping that entire engine running is social media. The data shows that 60% of people use platforms like Instagram for party inspiration.
Well, the mechanism there is crucial to understand. Social media creates this endless feedback loop of performative consumption.
Right. It's not just a party anymore.
Exactly. You aren't throwing a party just to gather with friends. You're throwing it to produce imagery. You have to prove to your network that you are adequately celebrating.
But the research points to an even darker side of this performance, especially around the legal drinking age. Depending on where you live, whether it's your 19th or 21st birthday, hospitalizations for alcohol-related risks don't just inch up, they skyrocket.
The numbers are terrifying, honestly.
We are looking at a 114% increase for men and a 164% increase for women.
And we really have to ask why that happens. It occurs because the milestone provides a culturally sanctioned excuse to completely bypass personal limits.
Yeah, it's like society gives you a free pass.
Society essentially tells you, hey, today is your day. The rules of biology and consequence do not apply.
Okay, wait, let me stop you there. Because I'm looking at this from the perspective of someone listening who, you know, just wants to have a nice day.
Sure, of course.
Is having a piece of chocolate cake and opening a funny card from your mom really this toxic act of consumption? I mean, are we criminalizing harmless fun here? It feels a bit like saying we shouldn't celebrate getting a promotion because the restaurant makes a profit off our dinner.
That is the natural pushback, right?
Yeah.
And it is vital we clarify Piru's stance here. He is not advocating for a joyless existence where you live like a monk in a cave.
Okay, good. Because I like cake.
We all like cake. The fundamental issue isn't the presence of a cake. It is the fact that the commercialization has completely hollowed out the meaning.
So it's about what the cake represents, not the cake itself.
Precisely. The focus has shifted away from a genuine assessment of your life's journey or your personal growth or just your survival over another year.
Right.
Instead, it's been replaced by egocentric indulgence. It is the mindlessness of the act. You aren't actually celebrating your life. You're acting as an obedient customer for the party and sick care industries.
Wow, the sick care industry.
Yeah, you are consuming massive amounts of refined sugar and alcohol simply because a marketing campaign conditioned you from childhood to believe that this specific combination of toxins equals happiness.
Okay, that makes sense. It's the difference between eating a really nice meal specifically to nourish your body and connect with your family versus just gorging yourself because the clock struck midnight and the script says it's time to eat.
That's exactly it. And that leads directly into how Puru suggests we fix this broken model. He anchors his solution with a very provocative quote. The refusal to think is evil.
Whoa. The refusal to think is evil. That is a really heavy statement to apply to a birthday party.
It is heavy, but it points to our ethical obligation to examine our choices. When we refuse to think about why we consume, we perpetuate systems that harm us physically and mentally.
So what does a good birthday look like to him then?
Puru argues a birthday shouldn't be a loud, egocentric celebration of entitlement. It should be a moment of backward-looking introspection.
Backward-looking introspection. I like that.
Yeah, it's a day specifically carved out to look at the past year or your entire life and find deep gratitude for how past challenges, even the deeply painful ones, have forged your character.
To make this practical, Puru actually breaks his philosophy down into what he calls a two-realm framework.
Yes, this is where it gets really actionable.
Let's explore the first part, the mental health realm. This is the inner work, and it completely upends the traditional midnight celebration. According to Puru, your birthday starts at sunrise.
Sunrise, not midnight.
Right. It involves journaling, quiet reflection, and setting very strict digital boundaries.
And that digital boundary is perhaps the most crucial modern adaptation here. Think about the cognitive load of waking up and having your emotional state dictated by hundreds of superficial well-wishers flooding your phone.
Oh, you mean like the people you haven't spoken to in 3 years sending a generic HBD on Facebook?
Exactly those people. By turning off the phone and intentionally ignoring that performative noise, you are aggressively protecting your attention.
You're taking the day back.
Yes. You're reserving your mental energy for genuine reflection rather than managing an inbox of social obligations.
Okay, so once that inner intention is set at sunrise, it has to be embodied physically. Which brings us to the second half of Puru's framework, the physical health realm, the outer expression.
And this is where the physical environment matters.
Yeah, instead of gathering indoors in like artificial light, this involves nature-based activities. It means observing the natural path of the sun and the moon, physically aligning yourself with the day.
And the food choices are completely different too.
Totally. Regarding food, he advocates for vegan, nutritionally beneficial treats that actually fuel your cellular biology, not the processed foods that guarantee a massive blood sugar spike and that awful subsequent crash.
Right, no sugar hangovers.
Exactly. And if you choose to celebrate with music and dance, you do it entirely alcohol-free, maintaining complete clarity.
And it's the synergy between those two realms that creates the actual growth checkpoint.
You know, the way I'm conceptualizing this, it's like your birthday is your annual systems check.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
The mental realm is updating your operating system, clearing out the cache, deleting the psychological malware of the past year.
Yeah.
But that software update means nothing if the hardware is failing.
Right. The hardware needs maintenance too.
So the physical realm is taking care of the actual machine, taking it outside into the sunlight, cleaning the vents, and giving it the premium power source it actually needs to function smoothly.
That analogy maps perfectly onto Puru's framework, and it also highlights how this approach is essentially a reclamation of ancient wisdom.
What do you mean by ancient wisdom?
Well, long before the Industrial Revolution, aligning with cosmic time, the rhythms of nature, and genuine human growth was just the norm. Various traditions utilized milestones not for consumption, but for profound reflection.
Oh, like what kind of traditions?
Like Buddhist reflections on impermanence, or Jewish traditions of spiritual reflection and charity on birthdays. Puru is asking us to step out of commercial time, which just demands we buy something, and step back into cosmic time.
Which sounds incredibly restorative in theory, right? Like a quiet sunrise reflection in the woods is a beautiful image. But let's bring this down to the messy reality for you, the listener.
Yeah, theory versus practice.
Exactly. How do you actually apply this framework in a modern society that fully expects loud, traditional, consumption-heavy parties? Because if you suddenly refuse to participate, you risk isolating yourself.
Puru totally anticipates this friction. He does not advocate for rigid, extreme isolation where you become some kind of hermit. He introduces a concept he calls pragmatic grace.
Pragmatic grace. I like the sound of that.
It's about intentional participation.
Okay, so how does pragmatic grace look when it's your own birthday?
When it is your birthday, you dictate the terms by inviting people into your values. Instead of renting a loud bar, you might invite your closest friends to a sunrise hike, followed by a highly nutritious home-cooked meal.
So you're changing the venue and the vibe.
You're actively reframing the cultural definition of enjoying life.
Yeah.
You demonstrate that enjoying life doesn't require a hangover the next day. It can mean being fully present, clear-headed, and deeply nourished by both food and authentic conversation.
Okay, but you also have to navigate other people's birthdays. This intentional participation naturally collides with the physical reality of attending a standard party.
It definitely does.
You can decline a drink, sure, but when the host hands out cake or when you are expected to bring a gift, you're suddenly participating in the material consumption Puru warns about.
This is where the grace in pragmatic grace comes in. You can attend an imperfect celebration. You don't have to stay home in protest.
So you still go.
You still go. You simply choose the healthiest food options available. You abstain from the alcohol, even if everyone else is drinking. You focus your energy on engaging in one or two deep, genuine conversations rather than shouting over loud music.
And then what?
And you leave and go to bed at a decent hour to protect your circadian rhythm.
Okay, that covers the party. But what about the gift-giving aspect?
Puru suggests completely replacing material trinkets with what he calls the gift of time. Instead of buying a plastic item that will just end up in a landfill, offer the person a walk and talk in nature.
A walk and talk.
Yeah, it provides what people actually crave, authentic connection being heard, without adding to physical clutter or environmental waste.
Now, we have to acknowledge that if you do this, you are going to face resistance.
Oh, absolutely.
If you show up to a party, politely decline the cake, refuse the alcohol, and then hand the person an IOU for a nature walk,
Yeah.
you are going to get pushback from friends and family.
Yeah.
Why does this trigger such a defensive reaction?
Because your mindful choices act as a psychological mirror. When you consciously choose health and reflection, it implicitly questions the automatic choices of everyone around you.
It makes them look at their own habits.
Exactly. It unsettles those who do not want to examine their own mindless indulgence. Often, people use the birthdays of their friends as a socially sanctioned excuse for their own excess.
Right, like, I'm drinking for you.
Yes. When you remove yourself from that dynamic, you remove their excuse, and the immediate reaction is usually defensiveness.
Let me present a really tough scenario here. What if someone's family insists on throwing them a massive traditional surprise party, complete with a refined flower cake and the open bar?
That's a classic dilemma.
They say they are doing it because they love you. Is setting these boundaries going to cause genuine harm to your relationships?
Navigating love and boundaries is arguably the hardest part of this philosophy. Puru addresses this through the concept of compassionate boundaries. The goal is to lead by example, never through loud evangelism or judgment of others.
So you don't stand on a table and announce that sugar is poison.
Exactly. You accept the love and the intention behind the family's gesture, but you remain fiercely consistent with your core beliefs.
How do you actually say that, though?
You might say something like, "I am so deeply moved that you wanted to celebrate me, but to truly honor my life and my body today, I'm going to pass on the alcohol and just enjoy your company."
That sounds reasonable.
It's about understanding that small, steady, graceful choices lived out consistently over years are what actually reshape the culture around you. You never have to win an argument. You just have to consistently live your truth.
And if we are talking about reshaping culture, we really have to look at where that culture begins. Puru's philosophy extends far beyond adult birthdays. He applies this framework to the entire human life cycle, starting with childhood.
Yes. How we handle children's birthdays is arguably the most critical part of his essay. Puru points out that children's birthday parties are essentially social programming in miniature.
Let's unpack that phrase, social programming in miniature. It strips away the innocence of like a bouncy castle and a clown and makes you realize you are actively training a consumer.
That is precisely what is happening. Current commercial culture teaches children from their very first year of life that for one day they are the absolute unquestioned center of the
Which
universe.
is a dangerous precedent to set.
Very. They are showered with unearned material goods and fed processed foods that cause extreme physiological reactions.
Oh yeah, the classic sugar high, followed by the spectacular meltdown. We have all witnessed it.
We have. And Puru suggests completely flipping this paradigm. Keep the gathering small and deeply focused on physical play. Serve nutrient-dense treats so the children actually feel good in their bodies.
And what's the core message for the kids?
The most important thing is to use the day to teach the child that they are an integral, connected part of a community and of nature, not a superior entity reigning over it.
That's a profound shift.
He poses a very uncomfortable question to parents. Are you throwing this elaborate, expensive party for the genuine developmental joy of your child? Or are you performing for the other parents on your social media feed?
Oof. That requires a brutal level of honesty.
It really does.
And this lens of intentionality, it applies to every milestone. Think about graduations. Instead of a massive consumption event centered on the graduate's ego, it should be an exercise in humility, reflecting on the immense privilege of learning and expressing deep gratitude to the teachers and mentors who facilitated it.
Beautifully said. And it applies to wedding anniversaries too. Rather than expensive, performative displays of wealth with jewelry or lavish dinners, it should be a quiet, renewed commitment, a meaningful conversation about the realities of a shared journey.
Which brings us to the ultimate milestone in the human life cycle, death. Puru argues that even our modern funerals have been hijacked by this culture of mindless indulgence.
This part of the essay is incredibly confronting.
It really is. He points out that families often celebrate the deceased by consuming the very things that may have contributed to their passing. You see people pouring a glass of whiskey or eating highly processed comfort food in honor of the dead. He calls this complicity in the sick care system.
And to understand what he means by the sick care system, we have to look at how modern medicine often operates. It is largely a system designed to treat the chronic symptoms of overconsumption.
Things like heart disease, liver failure, metabolic syndrome.
Exactly. Rather than promoting holistic preventative health, when we use a funeral as an excuse to consume toxins, we are perpetuating the exact habits that fill those hospital beds. We should be honoring their life through healthy, vital remembrance.
What's really fascinating is that if we look outside our modern Western bubble, the supplementary research shows that other cultures handle death with far more meaning, vitality, and health than we currently handle our birthdays.
The anthropological data offers a brilliant contrast here. Think of Mexico's Day of the Dead, Día de los Muertos.
Right, it's not sad and gloomy.
No. It is not a solemn, consumption-heavy avoidance of reality. It is a vibrant, communal celebration of the deceased's journey, deeply rooted in storytelling and genuine connection across generations.
Or look at the traditions in Ghana. They construct these elaborate fantasy coffins. If someone was a master fisherman, they might be buried in a beautifully crafted wooden fish. If they were a farmer, a giant cocoa pod.
That's incredible.
It physically honors the specific skills, passions, and the actual life journey of the person, integrating their identity into the community's memory.
And we see it in the jazz funerals of New Orleans, too, where the community literally dances the person into the next phase of existence.
That's that imagery.
What these cultures all share is a profound understanding of the mechanisms of grief and celebration. They integrate the milestone into the natural cycle of life. They gather authentically. They process the emotion physically through movement or art, and they reflect deeply on the journey.
They don't outsource the ritual to a greeting card company.
Precisely.
When you look at the mechanics of a jazz funeral or a Dia de los Muertos gathering, they are actively processing the human experience. Meanwhile, we are sitting in a dark room eating refined flour because the calendar told us to. So how do we synthesize all of this? How do you, the listener, flip the script?
It really comes down to recognizing one core truth. Every milestone from birth to death is simply a checkpoint. Over the last century, we have allowed massive commercial forces to capture these checkpoints and turn them into toll booths of consumption.
Toll booths of consumption.
The goal is to reclaim them. We must strip away the marketing and return these days to being about profound presence, authentic human connection, and a rigorous, honest honoring of the growth that has occurred.
Reclaiming our checkpoints. That is the mission. As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to highlight Piru's ultimate, highly optimistic invitation to his readers. He doesn't write from a place of judgment or, like, doom and gloom.
No, he's very hopeful.
He's incredibly hopeful about what this philosophy yields. In fact, he jokes that he hopes to see everyone at his 110th Summer Garden birthday party in the year 2079.
2079.
Yeah. He is living this philosophy daily to prove that these mindful, intentional choices lead directly to a long, joyful, and deeply connected health span.
It is a wonderful image, and it pulls all of this abstract philosophy into a very tangible, physical reality.
So here is our challenge to you. Look ahead to your next milestone. It could be your birthday, a work anniversary, or a graduation. You do not have to change everything overnight and become a perfect philosopher.
Just start small.
Exactly. Just pick one element of Piru's framework. Maybe you commit to waking up for a quiet sunrise reflection before you check your messages. Maybe you completely power down your phone for the entire day. Or maybe, instead of handing a wrapped plastic gift to a friend, you offer them a genuine walk and talk in the woods.
Just try it.
Try it. Just execute one small change and notice how different it feels compared to the old, exhausted script of consumption.
And as you ponder how you might implement that, consider one final, remarkable piece of reality we uncovered in the supplementary research regarding animal behavior.
Oh, this is the absolute perfect thought to leave you with. Science shows us that elaborate celebrations are completely unique to human beings. There's not a single other animal species on this planet that tracks and celebrates the anniversary of its birth.
Not at all.
The very concept of celebration is a purely human construct, born entirely from the immense complexity of our advanced neocortex.
Which means it is a conscious choice. We are not driven by some inescapable biology to buy a cake, blow out candles, or throw a party. We invented the entire concept.
Exactly. And since this ritual is a product of our incredible advanced consciousness, shouldn't we use that very consciousness to genuinely reflect on our existence? Instead of using our highly evolved brain simply to justify consuming more resources and sugar than any other species on Earth, we could use them to truly understand and celebrate the profound depth of the human journey.
It brings us right back to the beginning. The cake, the candles, the song, they are just props in a script you didn't write.
And it is entirely up to you whether you keep reading that script on autopilot or if you decide to finally take out a pen and write your own. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Piru's work. Take care of yourselves, and we'll catch you next time.